I'm going to screw up his name.
Le Chiffre.
Le Chiffre.
I'm just going to call him Le Chiffre, though, because I'm not doing the Le Chiffre.
I just called him, I put him in my notes as LC.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Real DMC Podcast. DMC stands for Dave, Marks, and Colin. Guys, are you ready to discuss the 1967 parody film? Starring David Niven, I believe. Casino Royale.
I love Niven. He's my favorite Bond.
He's your favorite Bond?
I did 17 pages of notes on this film.
I have a soft spot for George Lazenby, actually.
Actually, I was going to mention Lazenby later, but...
Is it Lazenby or Lazenby?
I say Lazenby.
All right, well, before we jump into it, we are seeing an ongoing increase in our listens, which is a lot of fun. We would love to hear from you as well. So if you'd like to get in contact with us, you can shoot us a message at feedback@realdmc.com as an email address, or you can find us on Twitter @RealDMC. Directed by Martin Campbell, we're here to discuss the overall 21st James Bond film, but it's the very first Daniel Craig James Bond film, and that is 2006's Casino Royale.
The man was Le Chiffre, private banker to the world's terrorists, which would explain how he could set up a high-stakes poker game at Casino Royale in Montenegro.
But if you lose, our government will have directly financed terrorism. I will be keeping my eye on our government's money and off your perfectly formed house.
You noticed.
By way of movie, just as some general introduction, this movie maintains an 8.0 on the IMDb. So this is actually the highest rated Bond film on the IMDb. Any guesses as to what the other top IMDb Bond films would be?
From Russia with Love.
Skyfall.
Skyfall is number 2 at 7.7, and From Russia with Love is number 4 at 7.4. So the first five, if you're going down just in terms of IMDb ranking, it's Casino Royale at 8. Skyfall 7.7, Goldfinger 7.7, From Russia with Love 7.4, and Dr. No at 7.2. And any guesses on what the bottom, say, three Bond films would be?
Die Another Day.
What are the Timothy Dalton ones?
I don't think the Dalton ones are that bad.
No,
actually.
I think they're pretty good. I don't like Dalton, but I think they're actually decent films.
He's got a great name for a bouncer.
He does. Or a cooler, actually. More specifically.
He's a cooler. Yeah. At the bottom, I'm going to say there's certainly some of the Pierce Brosnan that were just like over the top.
Well, you did call the first one correctly in terms of the overall lowest rated, which is Die Another Day at 6.1.
Yes!
So nicely done. The other
Which was the previous Bond to Casino Royale. So the lowest rated was then followed up with the highest rated.
Yeah, interesting. And there's a reason for that. If it wasn't the lowest rated, we may not have actually gotten this version of Casino Royale. And we'll go into that.
By the way, Die Another Day was also heavily criticized for the abundance of product placement. It was actually, a lot of people, I guess, were calling it Buy Another Day. And that's one thing I remember about those Brosnan movies, man. There was just product placement. It was out of control. Actually, I don't like Brosnan as Bond. We can get into the Bond discussion, but just to round off the IMDb, so the other two lowest Bond films, so Moonraker at 6.3.
I was going to say that one too.
And View to a Kill at 6.3. And I'm actually shocked that Moonraker and View to a Kill, truthfully, I'm shocked that View to a Kill was not the very bottom rated Bond film, because I think that has to be one of the worst.
Yeah.
It has Grace Jones as a Bond girl. I'm not sure that that works for me.
That definitely does not work for me.
I'm kind of afraid that, you know, she might pull my dick off or something like that. She appears a little frightening, so very powerful woman. So not unattractive, just scary to be in bed with, potentially. For the box office, so the overall budget for this film was $150 million. It made $167.4 million domestically, and it made $600 million worldwide. So it was definitely a success. After this film came out, Skyfall made, I think, like Spectre made $880 million, and Skyfall made $1.1 billion. So the Daniel Craig Bond film really did, you know, revitalize the franchise. it's, you know, it was off to the races once they got Craig in the role. And I think the quality of the Bond films with Craig have been really good. So I definitely have thoroughly enjoyed them.
Well, I think they took the franchise in a whole new kind of direction. Before, they were doing just kind of over-the-top action movie. And they actually started, with Casino Royale, they actually started making real movies, like actual interesting plots and characters, and not just how much action can we pack in.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, look, this was a conscious decision because, you know, Die Another Day wasn't very good. And it was, it, like you said, it was very over-the-top. There was just a lot of CGI stunt work and product placement, and they made this decision to like reboot the series basically, and they wanted to show a less experienced and more vulnerable Bond, and they did an amazing job. I mean, they really did. Like, they had some goals, and I think they completely nailed it. They did not want to have all the Bond tropes in it. They did not want to have the campiness, like all that stuff that you're basically, I think people were like just tired of that sort of thing. It's like over and over again.
Well, that was one of the problems with the Brosnan Bonds in my, or those films in my mind. The gadgetry was way, way off the charts, out of control. Remember I think on one movie was he like surfing a tidal wave or something like that? And there were lasers and all sorts of shit. Like the lasers. The last couple, yeah.
Sharks you know. With lasers on their heads.
Well, I mean, that's, yeah. I mean, the Brosnan films almost became a parody of Bond, is what it felt like a little bit to me.
But even the earlier ones are heading towards that direction. Even with the Roger Moore ones, they had a lot. It was more about the gadgets and more about the gimmicks and things along those lines.
Well, so this is really interesting because they sort of decided to do this once before. And that's when they brought in Timothy Dalton, right? Because Dalton was like a dark Bond. I mean, he was like, this guy, did he ever crack a smile?
A little bit more thuggish, actually.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And by the way, more true to the character. Did you guys read any of the Fleming novels back in the day?
No, but yeah. I know that they took the character back to the roots in this movie, in Casino Royale. And I think they did the same thing with Timothy Dalton.
Casino Royale was actually the very first Bond film that Fleming, I'm sorry, the Bond book that Fleming wrote.
Right. And for this movie, they wanted to keep the script as close as possible to that 1953 novel.
Right. Well, let's just talk Bond in general. So, first of all, just general question. You know, James Bond, when you were growing up, was that a really important fictional character in your life? You know, did you seek out Bond films? Was it a big part of your growing up?
Yeah, I really enjoyed him. I enjoyed, like, I grew up with Roger Moore and then would rewatch the Sean Connery ones. And they were all great. Like, I really enjoyed most of the films, and they were just good, fun action movies.
What was your first Bond film?
It's probably like one at Moonraker. What was the one before the
Spy Who Loved Me?
Yeah, Spy Who Loved Me is probably the first one.
Yeah. How about you, Colin?
Same. I think this is a character that sort of like people loved, and you weren't seeing a lot of the interesting things like the gadgetry and that you would see like in each of these new movies. And so that was very fun. It was a good character. I think I have the same experience. I saw The Spy Who Loved Me, and then my parents took me to see Moonraker in the theater, and then my dad started showing me the Sean Connery Bond movies, and I was like, oh, like, this is much better.
Yeah.
Because it was like, oh, Roger Moore was like so great, and then you see Connery, and you're like, oh, no, okay, this is James Bond. They were like really great movies. I think I really liked them up through like high school, and then I just sort of like, you know, it's like, oh, another Bond movie. You know, you'd see them, but I think they sort of lost a lot of luster over the years.
Yeah, so for me, it was The Spy Who Loved Me, and that actually remains probably one of my top Bond films overall. I really do love that movie. What would you say each of you is maybe, you know, some of your top Bond films?
I would say Skyfall is my favorite. I like it even more than Casino Royale, which I know you guys like this one the best.
How about you, Colin?
I'm just going to say two films. This one, which I love, and From Russia with Love.
Yeah, I would probably go this one, The Spy Who Loved Me, and maybe Thunderball. I really do like Thunderball. That's actually probably my favorite Connery Bond film.
Yeah, I need to rewatch the Connerys. I haven't seen them in quite a while.
Yeah, I haven't seen any of these in a long time, and I think there's a reason for that, is that they just appear very old. Yeah.
Well, the problem is, like, you have it's the over-the-top villains and the bases, and, you know, they're unintentionally a parody of the genre when you're watching them in some respects. So you take a look at what Austin Powers did, for example, and when you go back and look at some of the actual tropes inside those Bond films, it's a little hard to watch, or in some cases it's a little bit weird.
It's very weird. I mean, they really were sort of the pinnacle for quite some time, and then I do love the Austin Powers and Dr. Evil. I mean, that's just like fantastic.
Right.
So you cannot watch a Bond movie anymore, an old Bond movie, without thinking of that and then just sort of laughing.
Well, especially if you go back and watch Dr. No. Have you guys seen Dr. No in a long time?
No.
There's a lot of stuff inside Dr. No that Austin Powers did a really good job of just completely kneecapping when you go back and try to watch the original. So. Yeah.
I mean, that's what I like about Casino Royale in the reboot is just the back to realism, back to like, okay, he's not a superhero. He's not like this.
Are we sure about that?
Yeah, he's a fucking superhero, dude. And he has a healing factor, I'm pretty sure.
He does have that.
The man cannot get winded. It's amazing.
Throughout the movie, he has like kind of that diehard factor of like he gets cut up, he's bleeding, he gets knocked down and beat up. And that happens throughout the movie and shows that he is a little more human. Yeah, he keeps going. And
he's pretty good with his makeup, though, I will say, in terms of covering up some of those wounds, because he's able to rotate back to a poker game after a stairwell fight, after he's all bloody. Like, no problem. Just roll back to the table.
He had a couple of nicks still. They showed him.
Yeah.
So. He did have to down a glass of whiskey. But yeah, you're right about that.
Yeah. All right. Well, so let me ask you this. Who is the best James Bond?
Yeah, Daniel Craig. I mean, it's hard to say if he's the best Bond or if those are the best Bond movies. So it's kind of... they go hand in hand to a certain degree.
Colin?
I don't think they're the same Bond. And because of that, they're pretty much 1A and 1B.
Craig and Connery.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'll personally just put Craig at the top at this point. You know, he's my favorite Bond. And I might say he's the best Bond, honestly. I know it's a different era. And I know that that's just heresy to even suggest that it's not Connery. And I do love those Connery films.
I don't think it's heresy to yeah. I mean, look, I think of it this way.
Those movies are 50 years old. Like, it's not.
Yeah, there's a 20th century Bond, and that's Connery. And there's a 21st century Bond, and that's Craig.
Yeah.
Just leave it at that.
That's a good way to look at it, actually.
I read a reviewer article somewhere talking about the Bond is the new, he's a post 9/11 character. So he's a lot more brooding. It's a lot more serious for it.
This is the modern Bond, you know?
Yeah.
And it does, which is interesting and ironic because it's the original Bond. Like you were saying, Dave, it's much closer to that. You know, like he's more violent.
He's a thug.
Yeah. He's definitely like more violent.
Right.
I like this because this movie is sort of it's the origin story. I think somebody had said that they wanted to do for Bond what Batman Begins did for Batman. And so I don't think we'd ever seen like that origin story, you know, in any Bond movie, because he sort of came fully formed, you know, but we get to see him, get his 00 license to kill in this movie, at the beginning of this movie. We get to see him be the more inexperienced and vulnerable person, and that's going to shape his character like going forward. And I thought that was a really interesting aspect of this particular movie.
Yeah, what's interesting is I never thought of either Connery or any of the previous Bonds really as that tough of a guy. Not that they wouldn't get in fights, but they're more suave, or I don't know. Like, it's hard to, like, and you see plenty of fights in the previous Bonds. So it's not that they weren't tough, but they didn't come across as scary maybe or menacing. Where in this, with Daniel Craig, he's definitely like a no nonsense, menacing figure.
Oh, yeah. He's brutal and he's cold.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. He didn't get, maybe that's a better, the cold part of it. Like, Connery never came off as that. He always kind of charming.
Suave. Yeah. It's like, you know, that suave, debonair, yeah. Charming.
And Craig has some of that, but it's like more.
You know, is tough when he needs to be, right? But well, that's, not
mean,
his, that's not
Connery's his. Connery's Bond had a little bit of a brutal edge to him once in a while as well, right? I mean, he didn't hesitate to kill people for sure.
Yeah.
The Roger Moore version was kind of halfway between, because he liked to drop the campy one-liner. That's why I do think that The Spy Who Loved Me is Moore's best Bond film, because he has a little bit of a more serious, harder edge to the role.
What is Moore's first Bond film?
Is it Live and Let Die?
I don't like that one.
No, that's one that's, I think, set in New Orleans. That's not a good one. It has the boat jump over the parking lot, actually, at the time was a Guinness World Record. Another world record in this movie, by the way, which we'll talk about at some point.
The car flip.
Yeah.
And it's talked about.
Which is why I love Casino Royale, because it doesn't, it's unique.
It's very clean. Yeah.
It doesn't, the villain isn't like too villainous. You know, there's nothing, it's not like the world is at stake. You know, it's just
terrorists.
It's all
just funding terrorists.
It's just money. It's just, yeah, I mean, that's all that it is.
It's just money. Yeah. It's funding terrorism, but it's not like, he needs to win the poker game or the world will blow up, you know?
Yeah.
It's more down to earth. It's realism and it works extremely well. And you can focus more on the great characters and performances. And the fun part is the poker games, you know? So.
Yeah. So just a couple of quick notes in regards to the production. So did you know that Quentin Tarantino made a pitch to make Casino Royale in 2003?
Yeah, I thought that was very interesting.
Yeah, and apparently he wanted to do it as a black and white, and I guess he actually wanted to do it with Pierce Brosnan as his original idea.
Yeah, and he wanted to set it in the 60s.
Right, so that wasn't going to work, obviously, because Brosnan's played the older Bond, or the current age Bond in the modern era, so I don't really know what they would have done with that.
Yeah.
I'm glad they did not go that way.
Yeah. It would have been interesting, certainly, but I'm glad that they did not, because then we get Daniel Craig.
Right. And then there was this huge search to identify the next Bond, and all sorts of names came up. Apparently the role was actually offered to Hugh Jackman, and he turned it down. Martin Campbell, the director, was really supporting or championing Henry Cavill to play Bond. Yeah. But Cavill was only 23 at the time, so they deemed him too young for the role, so they passed on him. And then Craig himself actually turned down the role because he was looking at the Brosnan films and saying that, it's all very formulaic and it's not something that he wanted to do. And then apparently when he was given the script and he read through the script, then he said, oh yeah, this is actually something different and I'm on board.
Yeah, there were a lot of other people that were considered, like Goran Visnjic from ER, who auditioned, but he couldn't master a British accent. The one that I was like, when I read it, I was like, oh, like I had not heard about Hugh Jackman, and that certainly would have been interesting.
Yeah.
But the other one was Carl Urban.
Oh, really? I didn't see Carl Urban because I saw about 200 names that were listed as people that were considered to play Bond.
Yeah. Yeah, he wasn't able to make the screen test due to filming commitments. But that one, I'm like, ooh, ooh.
Yeah, he might have been too dark. I don't know.
I don't know. I love Carl Urban.
I've been watching Boys, so like he's pretty dark.
If that would have changed his career trajectory and we have not would have gotten Dredd or The Boys, though, that would have been, or even his Bones portrayal, that would have been a crime. So,
well, speaking of The Boys, did you know that Anthony Starr was also screen tested?
Oh, really?
Anthony Barr, who plays Homelander in The Boys.
Yeah, that's interesting. That would have been a good one. And I did see, by the way, Gerard Butler's name was up there as well.
Okay.
He could have been interesting. Yeah, he could have been really good.
That would have been an interesting
one. That would have been interesting.
I don't know if he could pull
Gerard
off
Butler, he's a lot more of an action. Yeah, I think he'd be more a good action Bond versus like what Craig. I think Craig's like such a perfect fit. I know, he has a look that harkens back to like both like Paul Newman and Steve McQueen and just that like kind of classic Hollywood.
He's got the piercing blue eyes and
exactly.
I mean, look, let's not say
just piercing blue eyes, but those appear to be like some sort of like a supernatural the way that they're lit, Like you expect lasers to come out of them a couple times. It's like, very ice blue, very very pretty eyes, Daniel Craig. Congratulations.
Yeah, I don't think the world is upset that Daniel Craig was cast. You said that.
No, but you know what? Did you read about the stuff that happened when he was announced? So
absolutely. Yeah, I totally remember it from
that
time.
Yeah, the UK press went apeshit. So they, and all the tabloids announced after the fact that he was too short, too ugly, too young, too blonde. Like these were all things that came up. And apparently also they were calling him James Blonde. Like that was something,
Yeah, the Daily Mirror ran a front page news story critical of his being cast. And they had it with the headline, "The name's Bland, James Bland."
Right. Yeah.
Well, it's interesting because when he was introduced at the press conference, I saw a photo of him and he was there like just in a business suit and his hair is longer. And it was kind of on the longish side.
Yeah.
He's blonde. He looks nothing like what you envision as James Bond. And that's why people got pissed. And I think it's safe to say that all of those protests died down immediately after the film came out.
Right.
And everyone was sort of like shocked and like immediately just like fell in love with his version of Bond.
And now all those people are crying that his last film's coming up.
Yeah.
Well, since we're kind of on cast, anything else you want to say about Daniel Craig as Bond?
I'll miss him. And looking forward to the final one.
I mean, he's just like sort of a revelation. He's a total departure from the previous versions of Bond. You know, he's vulnerable, he's troubled, he's flawed. And I like all of that. It made this is one of the reasons why I like this movie so much, is that it really did reinvigorate the franchise. Not just with his Bond, but also just the getting rid of a lot of the Bond movie tropes. You know, the gadgets, the campiness, the even the score, the music. You know, they do not use the James Bond theme until the end credits.
Yeah, they do it at the beginning, don't they? When he first turns and shoots.
They just do that. I think they do a little bit. just a tiny bit, the dun dun dun. Yeah. No, or do they? I'm not sure.
Yeah, there's a little bit there.
I think they do, but then they quickly go into the
Chris Cornell.
The Chris Cornell song. Yeah. And then they use the Chris Cornell song, parts of that, through the rest of the movie instead of using the James Bond theme.
He turned the franchise, like the franchise was more or less like the Mission Impossible franchise. They're fun movies. They're good, but they weren't anything special. And he turned it around to be like, okay, these are like must-see movies.
Yeah. I think the thing that I really like is the depth of the character that he's able to bring to the screen. So all the vulnerability, like you mentioned, where, you know, he's in the car and he's trying to get the defibrillator connected, right? Or the look of, you know, surprise on his face when he sees that he's being betrayed by Vesper, or
spoiler.
Yeah. Hey, it's only the 20-year anniversary of this movie. So if you haven't seen it yet, what the hell is wrong with you?
By 20-year, you mean 15?
Yeah.
Yeah, we'll go with that.
That's what I meant.
So anyways, I think we all roundly agree that Daniel Craig is pretty much awesome in this role.
No, I'm kind of like, I love him as Bond. I think he's great. I'm kind of glad this is his last film. I think he's gotten, the last few have been kind of blurred together and been a little too similar. So I think I'm looking forward to another new Bond, what else they can do with the role. Like, I think he's taken it pretty far and done great things with it, but I'm looking forward to see what's after.
You know, I can get alongside that. I think, you know, nobody wants something to go on and on and on forever and ever. Well, I guess there are certain things that you might, but no, it's time for change, right? It's like, go out on top.
You want to stay in that villa on the Mediterranean with Vesper?
So, and it's like, you know, go out on top. Nobody wants to say, hey, we're tired of
Nobody wants to Craig. See the Roger Moore shit happening,
exactly.
Right? Where it's like, you know, I mean, Roger Moore in View to a Kill, it's like, oh man, dude, it's, you know, you're way past your prime here. Yeah. This is not right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
One quote of his that I thought was really interesting, I think you might enjoy it. So Daniel Craig was saying that in sort of like formulating how he would do the character, he said he was inspired by MI6 and Mossad agents because, quote, Bond has just come out of the service and he's a killer. You can see it in their eyes. You know immediately, oh, hello, he's a killer. There's a look. These guys walk into a room and very subtly they check the perimeters for an exit. That's the sort of thing I wanted.
Hmm. Yeah, and apparently he also read all the Fleming novels before he started playing the character.
There you go. He did his research.
All right, so moving on to the cast. So Ava Green is Vesper Lynd. She's a really good... I love the fact that she is such a... sort of a foil for a lot of the early kind of like Bond machismo. Like, you know, she shuts him down when they have the conversation on the train. They go back and forth when they're exchanging the clothes. So I do really like the fact that as a character that, you know, they give her a ton of agency and allow her to, you know, stand tall and, against James Bond. So it's not like she's, you know, rolled over and seduced as one of the typical Bond women. And that's one of the reasons why I think it's a stronger role than a lot of the Bond girls in the past.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think she stands in and is not blown off the screen by him. She's able to hold her own, and she's able to definitely... I like the chemistry between the two of them.
Yeah, I mean, Dave, you took the word right out of my mouth. She's the perfect foil to his Bond.
Yeah.
And this is why, like you said, as a Bond girl, I immediately thought, like, she's not a Bond girl. Because she's so not typical, the typical Bond girl. You know, like, I could see, like, Solange, you could say that she's a Bond girl. But her Vesper Lynd is just such a strong woman, right? And she immediately sort of sees through his hyper-masculinity. Right. And they just, like, every scene of them, just the two of them together, I love. My favorite scene in the movie is the one where they meet on the train. It is so fantastic. And I asked Emily what her favorite scene was, and she immediately said that one too.
Yeah.
It is just such good stuff. They have amazing chemistry together. And yeah, she's a very beautiful woman as well.
Yeah.
But she really lights it up.
Yeah. Apparently Angelina Jolie and Charlize Theron were both considered for the role.
I wouldn't want to see Angelina Jolie in that role. Charlize Theron would be interesting. So I was sort of like going, oh, an Audrey Tautou, she was also considered. And I was thinking about all of them. And then I watched the movie again for the 20th time. And I was just, I can't take my eyes off of Ava Green. She's just amazing. She's so great in this role. And I kept wondering, like, why hasn't she had like a better career? I don't know that she's been in anything that was like a major success. I think that she was market corrected by Emily Blunt.
Really?
Yeah. Because they were both, this movie came out at the same time as The Devil Wears Prada. And I think Emily Blunt started getting a lot of the roles that they would be up for. Every time I think of Ava Green, I sort of picture Emily Blunt and I sort of get the two confused.
Yeah.
Like I could have seen Ava Green in Edge of Tomorrow, right? Like she could have done that role, right? But it's Emily Blunt. Like I could have seen her in like Looper, but no, it's Emily Blunt.
Yeah.
I just think that, yeah. And she's gone on to have a really good career, Emily Blunt has. Yeah, I just think maybe that was it.
Okay, well, moving on. So Judi Dench plays M, and I love Judi Dench's M. I love her in this role. I love the no-nonsense bullshit. I love some of the lines that she has. Like, for example, when she's pissed off at Bond, because Bond ends up shooting somebody, and, you know, it's captured on camera. And she says, you know, if he would have the good decency to defect, like, because she's so pissed off at him. So, I don't know. I really love Judi Dench I love Judi Dench as an actor anyways, but I just love her as her in this M role.
She's like the first M that I think you actually care about. Like, has anyone ever really cared about M in any of the previous films?
No, yeah. The M in all the other Bond films was just this dude sitting behind a desk, right? And he was there for the opening description of what the mission was, and then you never saw him again, right? So you'd see Q, obviously, you know, he'd walk past Moneypenny. By the way, no Q and no Moneypenny in this film, so I did find that interesting.
Right, I did like Ava Green's opening line was the...
Right, I'm the money. Yeah, yeah. And he's like, every penny of it. Yeah, I like how they call that out. You know... I was sitting there and I'm taking my notes on Judi Dench and I'm going like, yeah, she totally nails M. Like it's really great. Good performance. I'm so glad that they cast her in this. And then I realized this is not her first Bond movie. Like she was like part of all the Pierce Brosnan Bond movies as M.
I don't even remember that actually. Yeah.
That's funny. I don't remember that at all.
Was she playing M in those movies?
Yeah.
Are you serious?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh my God! Wow, that's how forgettable those Pierce Brosnan movies are. Seriously, I mean, I had no idea. I thought this was her first.
Me too.
crazy. Okay.
Well, that's a good. I mean, that's just a testament to how well her character is actually fleshed out and developed in this film, and how she does have she plays off Bond really well, and like they do have a great relationship between the two of them. You know, it's sort of antagonistic to a certain degree, but it's in a good way.
Like, well, it's like good,
playful
mother scolding the naughty schoolboy.
Yeah,
exactly. Right.
No, she's great, and I love her throughout all the other films too.
She ends up and it also gives him an emotional hook as the series goes on.
Yeah,
yeah. So that's kind of good.
I mean, she's like taking a risk by promoting him so early and young, and so she's sort of put her ass on the line a bit.
Yeah.
You know, is he too arrogant? Is he too, you know, too much ego? And what does he do? Like one of the first things he does is like, you know, disappoint by killing a guy on camera. But, you know, they do.
Bit of a rough start.
Yeah. They do have a, you know, special relationship.
Yeah, and the two of those, or the two of them as actors, have really good chemistry between the two of them.
Yeah, definitely. Those are good scenes between them.
It really works. Yeah. Okay, so then moving on. So Jeffrey Wright shows up as Felix Leiter. And so Felix has been, you know, long-term character going back to the Fleming novels. And he's been played by 7 different actors in the Bond series itself. So, I mean, Jeffrey Wright, not a huge role. He does show up as Felix in, I think, at least 2 other Daniel Craig Bond films, if I recall.
But Jeffrey Wright's a great actor. So, you know, he stands out a little bit. I like how he says, like, you know, I'm a brother from Langley.
Yeah.
it's good stuff.
Then you have Mads Mikkelsen as Le Chief or Le Chiffre, depending on how we're going to pronounce it.
I'm not gonna go there because my French is terrible.
He's great. He's a fantastic villain. I love the... he's got a great severe look and intensity to him. He's great.
Mads Mikkelsen is my secret MVP for this movie. I love his performance so much. He's fantastic. And I like the character because, again, like I said, you know, he's not like some super villain, you know.
He's an accountant.
Yeah, he's a terrorist financier. But he's incredibly smart, you know. He's a math whiz. He totally schools Bond at the table, you know, at least once. But Mads Mikkelsen, and this is the first time I'd ever seen him, the actor, and he nails it. He's so good. Do you guys know him from anything else?
Not before this, but after, for sure. Like, I watched the Hannibal series. If you watch that, yeah. He's really good as Hannibal.
Oh, my God. I loved that series, and he was such a great Dr. Lecter.
Yeah, he was fantastic.
I didn't see that series.
It's very, like, very gory. Like
it is, but it's...
Especially for network TV.
But in a beautiful sort of way. It's a really beautifully filmed show, but it's macabre. It's definitely macabre. Sure. Dave, you would like it. I know that you would like it.
Yeah, it's really good.
Yeah, I mean, at some point, maybe I'll go back and check it out. And then I've seen him in, you know, different movies in different roles. And usually I associate him with, you know, someone, you know, dark, disturbed, or, you know, evil, whatever.
He's a great villain.
So, and I always feel bad for guys like that get continually cast in roles. It's like, you know, what if he's just a really nice guy?
Yeah, he might be, but I think he's okay with it.
Yeah, that's fine. Getting steady work. The last person I would highlight would be Giancarlo Giannini as Rene Mathis.
Yeah,
and, sure. You know, he's definitely an actor that I've seen in a lot of different, you know, roles, small parts, and also very compelling. Somebody, you know, kind of like Jeffrey Wright, very watchable. So they ended up pulling some really good acting talent into this movie.
Okay, I just wanted to call out Tobias Menzies, who plays Villiers, who's M's secretary. Just wanted to give him a shout out because I love him as an actor. He does a lot of television. You know, he's in Rome, The Crown, Outlander. And of course, who can forget his Edmure Tully in Game of Thrones, who cannot seem to fire an arrow very well. Great Edmure, I have to say.
Shout out completed.
Okay. He'll appreciate it.
You go, Tobias.
Okay, well, and then, so just wanted to touch on the director. So Martin Campbell, which is, it's funny because if you had put a gun to my head and said, who directed Casino Royale, I would not have been able to come up with that name.
I could.
Really?
Yeah, because only because I love this movie so much, but, you know, think about his other filmography and it's like, huh, really? Like, has he done anything good? And the question is, or the answer is, yes, he did one other film that I love, and that's The Mask of Zorro.
He made the Zorro film, which he made Goldeneye, by the way. He was the director for Goldeneye, which is why he was chosen to direct this film. And I do think that Goldeneye, I recall that being a pretty good Bond movie. He also made the 1994 Ray Liotta post-apocalyptic prison escape film, No Escape. So, if, do you guys remember that one?
Nope, never even heard of that one.
But then he also made Green Lantern. And then I noticed that...
yeah, I saw that.
I noticed that his directing opportunities slowed down a bit after that. Or maybe he was just taking a break to recenter himself. I'm not sure.
Obviously, his greatest work, though, is his probably one of the greatest episodes on television on Homicide: Life on the Street. And I'm not making a joke. It is a really excellent episode. But Three Men and Adina is a great, great episode on Homicide, if you can ever find it anywhere. One of the best episodes ever.
Is that where... is Pembleton in the box?
Yeah, Pembleton's in the box. That's when breaks... what's the rookie's name? Bayless. That's a breaks Bayless.
Yeah, Bayless.
And he just kind of He just loses it.
Adina, that's the case that he just is obsessing about, right?
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Marcus, you should do a homicide podcast. Just get it all out of your system.
Oh, it's a great, like if it was streaming anywhere, we
could we watch Homicide without smoking?
I don't know. It'd be a tough one. But that is a great episode, and I was surprised to see that Martin Campbell was the one who directed it.
All right, well, you guys ready to jump into this thing?
Yeah, let's do it.
By the way, this was a Audible off of my pick, which was originally going to be Booksmart, over to Casino Royale. So, Marcus, are we saying this is your pick?
Yeah, we can take my pick.
Marcus, why did you pick this movie?
The new Bond movie is coming up. It's topical. It's the last Craig movie coming out, and what better time to do the first Craig movie?
It's the 20-year anniversary, because it says so right in my notes.
All right, so from a plot summary standpoint, you guys want to throw out a plot summary? Anybody?
Casino Royale takes place at the beginning of Bond's career as Agent 007 as he is earning his license to kill. The plot has Bond on an assignment to bankrupt terrorist financier Le Chiffre in a high-stakes poker game at the Casino Royale in Montenegro. Bond falls in love with Vesper Lynd, a treasury employee assigned to provide the money he needs for the game.
All right, and that's the Real DMC podcast signing off.
Bond plays poker against evil dude.
James Bond gets swept up in the Texas Hold'em craze.
So this is like the time, right? This is when like Hold'em was like just all the rage. I mean, it still is, but when did
Chris Moneymaker win the because I think ESPN ended up. They showed the World Series of Poker, and that was the year that Chris Moneymaker won, and then it was a big explosion after that.
It was 2003, so 3 years prior.
Yeah,
but I think it was a smart move, honestly, because
For sure,
I actually knew what was going on. I could follow the game.
I did like though how they had some of the characters that they gave Mathis the need to provide some poker exposition briefly. He'll have to go all in, right?
So it's necessary if you have no idea.
They have the character saying like just, you know, very basic poker orientation to try to get people that don't play poker some rudimentary understanding of what's happening. All right, so the opening of the film, I did think the credit sequence or the, you know, the opening, the production symbol and all that being in black and white was kind of fun because it starts off and you see he shows up in somebody's office and then you get a flashback to what was Bond's first kill. And it's what's really enjoyable about that scene is, well, first of all, just having it in black and white, I think is kind of cool. But also you see Bond and that initial fight is something that is very sloppy looking, right? So he's not the suave, sophisticated. He's not on top of it. It's just is this, you know, kind of random brawl and they're doing whatever they can to hurt each other. One thing about the fight though, actually goes to drown him in the sink and he only holds his head underwater for 13 seconds. before he lets go and the guy slumps to the floor. So I did think that maybe that would have been a really quick assumed drowning. That was my one observation about that fight.
Well, he didn't actually kill him then, you know, because...
Right, and then the guy wakes up and then he spins and shoots him and that's, you know, that's how you get your opening.
Yeah.
But I did think the opening scene, particularly the sloppiness, I thought was pretty cool the way that they put that together.
Yeah, I thought it was really good. I like the... During the fight too, like I think he thinks he's knocked out or he thinks he's killed. He was all out of breath and he just kind of gathers himself up. Kind of nice transition from like out of control to like, okay, let's.
There are several moments where you see him sort of he has to, you know, kind of get his shit together and just take a pause and then, you know, sort of, you know, figure things out and move forward. And so it actually humanizes Bond a little bit versus having him be this.
It makes it very like realistic and very like, okay, like, you know, he's not superhuman, right? He does have to like, you know, this is affecting him and it has to.
Yeah. Well, and that opening scene ends though and then he. You know, he decides that he's going to, or he ends up killing the other guy who he was hiding in his office. And he's much more assured about pulling the trigger at that point to kill the guy because the guy says, oh, the second one's going to be easier. And he doesn't even get the word easier out before Bond clips him.
Yeah.
Yes, considerably. Yeah. This is a great opening because that fight in the bathroom is totally brutal and it's sloppy. It shows his inexperience and it totally sets the stage for this not being, you know, the Bond movie that you're used to.
Right.
And I do love how he says, like, Dryden asks him, like, how did he die? And Bond says, your contact? Not well.
Yeah.
It's great. And then, boom, they go into the gun barrel and the credits.
Yeah, they go into the credits. The one thing I'll say about the Chris Cornell song is I don't think it particularly is a memorable Bond theme. I don't really think it works as a Bond theme at all.
Really? I like it.
I like the song, but I did not know it was like, when it started again, I'm like, oh yeah, Chris Cornell is the title song. Or,
yeah, I mean, I really like Chris Cornell, but so I'm just surprised that I don't like the song, but I don't think it works. Maybe it's just, I don't think Cornell's voice works as a Bond theme. I don't know.
Yeah, I think you need more of that.
You're more Sheena Easton.
Well, For Your Eyes Only is a very good Bond theme.
I mean, it's a great song, yeah.
Yeah,
it is. Skyfall too. I like the Skyfall song. Adele.
Maybe that's why, because it's a man singing and not a woman.
Yeah. It's also a lot harsher. And I think that's why they did this song too. It's not.
By the way, I do like A View to a Kill by Duran Duran.
That one's good too.
That was a very catchy song. So
setting the stage, Uganda.
So we go to Uganda, and this is where we meet Lashif, presented to some group of terrorists. And basically what they do is they say that they're willing to invest their money with him, and he is going to give them a guaranteed return and make sure that they can access their funds anywhere in the globe. So that's basically the services he provides as a money launderer. And the person that introduces Lashif to the terrorists is, I think he's Mr. White. I think that's his name, right? So he's a member of the Spectre organization, which you're not familiar with who those people are, and you don't even really figure that out at the end of the movie, but he does show up at the end of the movie as well.
I'll tell you why you don't figure that out. They didn't have the rights at the time to use the name Spectre.
So the rights to Casino Royale and some of the elements of Casino Royale had to be negotiated with Sony, and like they did a swap for Spider-Man versus the some of the Bond rights, the extended Bond rights.
Sony, Bony. I think the only other interesting part in that opening scene was he immediately shorts Skyfleet after he gets some money, which makes you wonder, what is Skyfleet?
Right. Yeah. So he does place a massive short order on some stock. And so you assume that there are going to be some shenanigans attached to that.
Do you believe in God, Mr. Lashif? I believe in a reasonable rate of return.
So from here, it does switch to Madagascar, and you see Bond, and Bond is with one additional agent, and they are watching the traditional cobra versus mongoose fight that's happening. So didn't we just watch a movie where there was some sort of an animal fight?
Was that Ricky Tikki Tavi?
No, they were doing it was the army, and they were playing with the cobra.
Cobra poker. That's right.
It was Gladiator.
In Gladiator, they're playing cobra poker. Yes. So I was just curious, though, cobra versus mongoose. So who's usually going to win that fight?
The mongoose, yeah.
Mongoose is going to win like nine out of 10 times, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's what they're built for.
He's a heavy favorite. Heavy favorite.
Yeah.
Who, by the way, trained Carter? He must be the world's worst agent.
That guy was a shitty agent, the guy that was with Bond, because he's holding his hand to his ear, gives away the fact that he has an earpiece in. The guy that they're tracking ends up spotting the fact that this guy's just locked in on him, just staring at him, by the way. So everyone's watching the fight except for, Agent Carter is staring right at this guy. So somehow he's tipped off that maybe he's being pursued.
And then he pulls out his gun, falls very embarrassingly backward into the arena, and shoots his gun off. I mean,
right, I know.
It's so like the world's worst MI6 agent.
That guy's getting a shitty performance report.
Yeah, the 360 feedback's not going to be good.
What they should have done is they should have had the cobra bite him. But then from here, this is where a pretty amazing chase starts. So the guy that Bond is chasing is a parkour expert for sure. And some of the parkour shit that is happening in this is just the act, the physical act that the stunt people are doing is straight up impressive. Like one of my favorites was the guy takes a running jump off of a platform and then just grips the side of a girder, like a steel girder, and then actually just keeps climbing up. Like, I don't even know how you do that. I mean, some of the parkour moves are just amazing to watch.
It really is. And I didn't even know what parkour was until like 10 years after I'd seen this film. And I was like, oh man, that's from Casino Royale. Yeah, it's really nuts.
It's really good.
It's so good.
And the one thing that I'll say is that Daniel Craig has a little bit of a T-1000 run to him. So he's got a little bit of the Robert Patrick run.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know if you noticed that, but
I'm
trying to decide if Daniel Craig looks good running or not. And I did not come to a firm determination on my opinion there.
I'm not sure it's great, but it looks like he's trying hard.
Yeah, he's got the arms whipping and he's going pretty fast.
And then he'll like run for like 10 minutes and then he'll stop and he's not even breathing hard. It's amazing. Nope. Like, no, I don't.
Healing factor. He's got a healing factor.
That's the thing. I think he is a T-1000.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, the stunt work is fantastic in that opening scene.
Oh, the stunt work's amazing. The scenery, like them going out and climbing on the crane and just being that high off the ground, and some of the aerial jumping,
jumping from one crane to another crane.
The stunt work, the opening stunt work in this chase is just remarkable.
Yeah, it's they also have like a really good shot. I think it's like they do like a double jump. Like Bond is doing one, like it's in the same scene too. They're like jumping from two different areas shown on screen.
Yeah,
really, really great. Well shot.
Yeah, and then so the other thing about this chase is that Bond has his own style, and so I do love how they contrast the two, because there's one scene in particular where the parkour guy, you know, jumps and he grabs the ceiling and he throws his body through a little, you know, 2-foot opening on the top of a door, and then you see Bond just basically run straight through the wall. So it's a little bit showing that, you know, he's got a little bit of a thug, harder edge. He's just kind of doing what he can do to chase this guy down.
Good. It's just great stuff. Way to open the film.
Yeah. The one thing I was surprised though, because there's not as much action through the rest of the film. Nothing really beats this opening scene, I don't think.
There's the scene at Miami Airport.
Oh, that's true. That one's pretty good. I don't know. This one just ends up being, maybe this is my favorite action scene in the movie.
I think so. Yeah. I think it's better than the airport.
Yeah.
Well, and it's part of the tradition of the Bond openings that always have the really crazy stunts and some of the stuff.
Yeah, one of the things I love about Bond films, and that's what these Craig films also bring back, is it's more realistic. They shoot on location. They're shooting the stunts.
As opposed to like green screen shit and all that? Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And it just feels a lot more real. And they're using and that's where Pierce Brosnan's movies, it was all CGI and they're doing all these like kind of wacky chases. Whereas this is like very real.
Yeah. Okay, well, the Madagascar scene ends, and this is where, so Bond is inside an embassy, and at the end, he decides to gun down the person that he was chasing, and then he shoots something, and there's an explosion. So, and he...
The bomb maker.
And then M basically chastises him for violating the one core rule of diplomacy in terms of not going into somebody else's embassy and fucking around, so...
Don't blow up other people's embassies.
Did we ever decide, like, if shooting the propane tank actually works?
I believe it does not, actually.
Yeah, I think Mythbusters did bust that myth.
Yeah. Okay, so then from here, this is where it shifts, and this is where we see Le Chiffre playing poker.
Is that sort of like Le Chiffre if he was a predator?
I did like the weeping blood as he played cards. I don't think they had enough blood weeping in the movie.
It's very sinister. Right,
so they give him the typical Bond villain where they have to have some sort of a physical trait or physical deformity or something like that. So in this case, he weeps blood. So you don't know exactly what's happening, but you know that he's making a negative bet in regards to the stock market. So you assume that he's trying to cause some bad thing somewhere to happen to a company, but you don't know much about it other than that.
I do like he's such a gracious host too, because give our guests 5 minutes to leave or throw them overboard.
Right. Yeah, not a terribly great host.
That's how I end all my parties.
Everybody out!
Yeah, and then so it shifts back briefly to M's apartment back in London, and Bond has broken into her apartment and is using her computer to look up some information. But she basically tells Bond to, you know, get out of town for a few days because she's thinking about allowing him to take his punishment for what happened inside the embassy. But of course, she doesn't end up doing that. Bond decides he's going to go to the Bahamas because he's really actually chasing a lead down. And then surprisingly, what you see here, and Marcus, I'm sure you have something to say, is the next thing you see is Bond is driving a Ford, which doesn't really feel right.
Yeah, he's driving a Ford Mondeo, which is in the U.S. is known as the Ford Fusion.
Is it the same car as the Fusion? I mean, is it just branded differently?
Like they do a lot of international ones. Because Fusion doesn't translate to the Bahamas.
I thought that there were some models that you would have in Europe, but that you wouldn't have in the U.S.
Yeah, this one's the same.
Yeah, I actually, you know what, I always liked that car. I think it's a nice looking car.
It's a fine sedan.
Was that was that Ford there specifically because of some sort of an endorsement deal that they set up?
Apparently,
I'm sure.
Like, yeah,
I'm sure. Yeah.
I think it's a nice nod to he's not the Bond driving the fancy car immediately.
Exactly.
Right.
So.
Yeah, that's a good point. He does, however, flip open a Sony Ericsson phone, and I know that because it says Sony Ericsson in big letters right in front of the phone he's using. So that one felt a little product placement-y to me.
Yeah, it's a little bit, but not. I don't think it's too bad.
Yeah.
They use cell phones a bit, and they all look very, very dated. This is movie came out in 2006, like the year before the iPhone, and all the phones do look very. It's fine. It doesn't. There's no flaw in the movie because
they all actually texting. They look like those. Remember those? What were those flip cameras? That's what they look like. They don't even look like, you know, phones. It's just sort of these small rectangular devices, kind of strange looking.
Definitely dated a little there, but
Bond is actually using is he has a timestamp of when a call went, and so that's what he's looking at. So he breaks into the security room. He does see somebody who makes a call at the exact time as a timestamp, and that person is driving a 1964 Aston Martin, which we'll get to the poker game in a minute. But I believe that car in that shape is valued anywhere from $650,000 to $750,000. Is that accurate, Marcus?
That'd be correct. The last one sold on Bring Your Trailer beginning this year for $625,000.
Yeah.
How much is that is in like 2006 dollars?
It'd be a little bit less.
I appreciate the accuracy.
There you go. It's a nice car.
Yeah. So Bond identifies that, you know, Dimitri was the one that made the call to the guy who was going to plant the bomb. And so he ends up working his way into a poker game with him. And as they're sitting there, by the way, all the poker hands in this movie, they're all really strong poker hands because, you know, Bond plays poker. He takes down, I think, three kings of Dimitri with three aces. And as they're sitting there and they're negotiating, this is what I thought was kind of funny, is that Bond pushes in his chips and he has more than what Dimitri has. So sitting there, and he brings out a checkbook, and he's going to write a check for $20,000. I'm not sure, I can't remember how much Bond was going to raise in that game, but he's going to write a check for $20,000, and instead he says, oh no, screw it, I'll just throw my car in. So he's actually raising $650,000. So to cover like a $5,000 bet. It's $5,000 bet. So it doesn't really seem to work.
Table stakes.
So of course he wins the hand, he wins the Aston Martin, and then he does one cool move. So he goes out front and he has the Aston Martin. And what's the name of the woman?
Solange.
Yeah, Solange, who is Dimitrios's wife, gets in the car and she's basically agreeing to go spend the night with Bond. And then Bond does this fun move where...
Well, have a drink.
Yeah, have a drink. Okay, well, come on. Where's it going? You know where it's going. Yeah.
But yeah.
So he drives the Aston Martin around. I like the moment where he drives it around in a circle and then comes right back to the club. So
it is.
I thought that was a pretty good move.
Yeah, it's great. By the way, you did skip over something very important. A scene that was very important. So
him coming out of the ocean.
Yeah. So when they're on the beach, and
is that your favorite scene in the movie?
It is not. However, I do have a few female friends who practically swoon every time they see Daniel Craig rising out of the ocean. I think that's a very pretty iconic scene for all of our female listeners.
It's a good one.
I also happen to love the shot of Solange riding the horse down the beach with all these children like running after, and then they just like stop, and then like the smile on this kid's face, and he just sort of sighs. It's like, it's so amazing.
It's pretty funny.
He was just supposed to be swimming up, and he unexpectedly hit a sandbar. And so he stood up, and that was not in the original script. And so when he stood up and came walking out of the surf, apparently that was not intended. It was also at the time not intended to be a specific homage to Dr. No. So, but the film ended up getting credit for it. So it's just kind of a happy accident.
Interesting, because I never thought about it that way. But I know that, because I read some people actually, yeah, they really did. They thought it was a callback. But didn't they all already pay homage to that scene with Halle Berry in one of the...
Yeah, when she was playing the Jinx character. In fact, I think she was wearing the exact same bikini.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. But yeah, that of course became one of the, like you said, sort of an iconic sort of introductory Daniel Craig Bond moment for sure. And I guess Craig, when he was going through his physical transformation, so he put 20 pounds of muscle on to play Bond.
Oh, wow. Yeah, I was wondering about that. He's jacked in this movie.
Oh, he's ripped, yeah.
They make lots of comments about his body too. It's pretty funny. I think there's at least three or four comments about like his perfectly formed ass and his great shape.
Even Lashif is getting a little he's getting a little randy with a naked Bond. he's talking about true. You sure keep yourself in shape.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So then Bond back at the Ocean Club with Solange, and it's pretty great because she, you know, they're getting ready to have sex, and then he finds out that Dimitrios is actually going to Miami, And so he orders a bottle of champagne and some caviar, and then he says, for one, and then he dashes out the door. So I do like that. I like that he ends up ditching Solange. I thought that was kind of funny.
He ordered beluga caviar. Colin, can you confirm? Isn't beluga a whale?
So would no, he ordered Bollinger Grand Agnier and some beluga caviar.
But would isn't beluga a whale?
Yes. But there's also
caviar like eggs?
But it's also, no, beluga sturgeon.
Oh, okay. There you go. Thank you.
So he flies to Miami and he ends up going to a, what was it? I mean, it would be some sort it's of a
body worlds,
body world. Yeah. So it's a,
I almost went to one. I did not ever see, have you guys gone to one?
That's where, is that where they have the bodies sliced up and then you can see?
Yeah,
the,
exactly. They, yeah. They,
yeah. I remember seeing it being advertised in Vegas, but I did not go to it.
To answer your question, Marcus, no. And the reason why I have not is because it looks fucking weird.
I don't know if I could handle it. I was going to go to one. I forget what ended up happening. I think I was in travel for a trip. I think it was in Chicago somewhere. And then ended up the trip ending it canceled or whatever. But.
So my one big question about this is that this is sort of late at night because, they've already had dinner and poker and they were going to, do it. And then he takes the late night flight to Miami.
Right.
And they go to Body Worlds and this place is bumping.
It's hopping.
What is going on here?
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know that that was kind of the time jump there and how he would, get on a plane and all that.
It's an hour flight and Bahamas could be an hour ahead too. So it could work.
But I'm thinking this is probably around 11 o'clock at night.
Yeah. Well, I do have some other questions about the rollout of the jumbo jet, which we'll talk about.
That's in terms the other timing part. There.
Yeah. So
who does their big promotional debut of their prototype at midnight,
10 o'clock at night or 11 o'clock at night, whatever it is. Yeah.
Yeah. But they're just doing it's like an exhibit. Their flight will be tomorrow. They're just showing it off.
All right.
But anyway, so at Miami, so there is a fun moment where Bond ends up, they have there's a knife duel that he has with Demetrios. And while they're in the museum, I do like that because it's just a moment where they're sitting there, they have the traditional, both guys have their hand on the knife and which way is it going? Is it going towards Bond? Is it going towards Demetrios? And then I swear that Bond gets him with a head fake of
absolutely.
Hey, who's that? Yeah. Over there. Hey, look at that. He gives him one of those, right? And
it's Demetrius a total head falls fake. For it. Yeah.
And then he stabs him in the kidneys with a knife. Yeah. And then of course he's, so then he is trying to follow another guy because Demetrius had dropped off a key for whoever this, another bad person at the Miami airport.
Carlos the Jackal.
I will note that Bond does run towards a very brightly lit Heineken sign as he's going through the airport. So Heineken does show up.
The product placement worked on Dave.
I was seeing it. Yeah. Well, you know what? Honestly, I was. You know what it was? I was looking for it after remembering the Brosnan films being so in your face with it. So I was curious to see if they dialed it down a bit, and they did. I mean, comparatively.
Did you notice Richard Branson at TSA getting security checked?
I did not notice that.
Yes, right. I swear to God, he's there.
Really?
Yeah. And then supposedly, on British Airways, they censored the movie by cutting that out because they're competitors.
Oh, yeah.
That's petty. And I did notice when he was running into the airport, the over the announcement, the voice was saying, the white zone is for loading and unloading only. Don't give me your white zone crap.
Cut the white zone shit.
I did think that. Every time I hear any voice doing the white zone is for loading or unloading only.
Is it airplane or airplane 2 with that one?
I think it's airplane.
I think it's the original airplane. Okay. Yeah. Well, so then Bond ends up chasing this guy out onto the tarmac. And what you realize is that this guy is going to attempt to blow up this new jumbo jet that's being rolled out.
The Skyfleet prototype. It's the largest airliner in the world.
Yep. But then here's where things get a little bit funky because the guy, he does have a security uniform on, but he walks out onto the tarmac. He kills the guy that was driving the gas truck and just throws the body right on the tarmac. And then he starts driving this thing around and just tear-assing around all over the place. And I'm just thinking, an American airport post 9/11, how far does this guy get before before someone shoots him, right, when he's driving around?
Oh, come on,
they did send the police out there.
He was in a uniform.
Yeah, he was behind because he had to go through security. Ellipsy ended up being the secure code to get through. And so it's close to plausible.
But what I want to know is, so he pulls the fire alarm, the sprinklers go off, everyone's panicking, they're running out. And he goes into what I guess was the security locker room. and he just grabs a gun that's just like hanging off of a locker. Like,
right. Yeah. Who's leaving their gun just
They might be around? Locked up.
Yeah. But of course, there is this big chase on the tarmac, and Bond, you know, does his best Indiana Jones in terms of jumping onto the gas truck and swings his way through the window and fights, and he ends up throwing the guy out of the gas truck and swerving it at the last second so that it does not crash into the Skyfleet prototype.
I would like to say that someone's not getting their luggage because they went right through that luggage train. It was like, oh boy, that's not good.
Yeah, and by the way, the other thing that happens is while they're going on the runway, they're being pursued. They are being pursued by airport police. So Colin, maybe you're right. Maybe they did get on it fast enough, but there is a plane that goes by. And at one point, the jet wash throws a car way up in the air.
It blows it completely.
Yeah. Is that, I mean, I had a question. I don't know. I mean, is that, could jet wash actually do that to a car like that?
Yeah. I think I've seen something where they showed it doing that. I don't know if it was like on Mythbusters or something else. They did not do that for this movie. That was CGI'd. But they created that effect by using like a crane and like basically pulling the car up in the air and backwards at the same time. It would actually do that.
Yeah, it was it's a fun effect.
Cool effect. It totally is. Yeah.
Yeah, and it's a pretty good chase overall. At the end, the gas truck has a bunch of holes in the side, so it's just spewing gas. It's parked right next to the Skyfleet prototype.
Yeah. By the way, you have to wonder at the police who were chasing them. They've got like some automatic weapons, and they're shooting at the tires of the gas truck. It's like, hey, you guys, you do realize that thing's loaded with fuel, right? Gas.
Yeah. Jet fuel, literally.
Come on.
I kind of did appreciate their bias to action, though, just to get out there and try to take the tires out. So they were getting after it. So good for them.
Well, this was post 9/11, so they're like, oh. Yeah, we gotta get them. Gotta get the terrorists.
And then, so of course, you know, Bond ends up saving the day there because what you find out is that the guy had attached a bomb to the truck that he was going to trigger with his handheld device, and then what Bond was able to do is take the bomb and actually clip it to this guy's belt, so he ends up blowing up himself.
That's a great little scene there.
Yeah, that's a pretty fun moment
because he's the chest down on the hood of the police car, and he's just like looking at him, and yeah, he gets a little tiny smile when he blows up. I'm glad they didn't show him blowing up, by the way.
Yeah. Not needed.
Yeah. So then Bond ends up meeting with M, and this is where what they realize is that Lachif, to try to get the 100 million back, he's hosting a poker game, so it's a $10 million buy-in with a $5 million rebuy. So it's kind of like the same stakes that we play when we play our home games. You know, about $15 million, right?
Just less zeros.
Like all of them.
Ours is usually $20, so it doesn't quite measure it.
Like all of them.
Yeah. $10 buy-in, $5 rebuy.
Yeah. So Bond has a chance to go to Montenegro, and this is where we referenced this earlier, but it cuts to him on a train.
I do love that, like, Lachif's first, he's like, oh, shit, I just lost $100 million. Fuck, I better play poker to get this money back.
Right.
I think it's a really interesting idea. It's like, how the fuck am I going to get, like, $100 million?
Yeah, well, and he's kind of desperate.
I know, like, I'm a great poker player, and so, yeah, I'm going to set up this high-stakes game, and I just have to win it, and then I'll get the money back, all that money that I lost. It's a really interesting idea. And then it's like, well, what does Bond have to do? Well, he just has to make sure that Lachif doesn't win.
And I do like the little bit of exposition that M gives, that Bond is the best poker player in the service. That was the one like justification. Okay, why is Bond the one going to the poker game?
Yeah.
You figure, though, that Bond is not a professional poker player. So the chances of him actually winning in a game like this?
Well, are
he's
any
the best
of these,
in the service.
Yeah. Right. Are any of these people professionals? No, they're just a bunch of rich assholes.
Yeah.
I assume.
There's that one guy who couldn't talk apparently, and he just went like just six fingers up when he was betting his $6 million.
Yeah, I want the background of the other eight players or seven players. I guess we know Felix.
Yeah. Yeah. So we talked about it before, but there is a great moment, which is the two of them on the train, right? So you cut to Bond. This is
best,
where you have the best
scene in the movie.
Best Berlin introduction. It is. It's really just the wordplay going back and forth between the two of them. And also we mentioned it, but again, Vesper standing tall in the face of Bond is just, it's a really
Yeah, and she like she's not easily charmed by him. You know, right. she already knows like who this guy is, and he's all ego, and like she's not going to be charmed by him. And I love how she says like, "Oh well, if you lose, our government will have directly financed terrorism." What looks good?
And I did like after like she kind of stands up to him. Bonds definitely seems kind of pleased about the challenge. He's not just like he's impressed.
Yeah, he's definitely energized by her.
Yeah, the whole idea of them like sort of like reading each other and then like, you know, sort of analyzing and like, oh, you're this, you're that, you know, like I can tell by the cut of your suit you went to Oxford or wherever, you know.
Right.
All of that is just
it's great.
Great stuff.
Yeah. So they end up getting to the hotel, and the other thing that's kind of fun is that Bond has, you know, been presumptuous and picked out a dress for Vesper to wear. And so he brings it to her. And then, of course, she turns around and says, here's a dinner jacket that I got for you. So
you're missing all the like all the great lines, like when they're in the car and he's reading off their like dossier of who their covers are supposed to be. He's like, oh, yeah. I'm Archibald Beach or something like that, you know. And then he's like, you're Miss Stephanie Broadchest.
She's like, no, it's not.
Yeah, you're right. That's a good line. I did think that was fun because, of course, it's a little bit of a callback or a play to the
exactly
the naming conventions of all the Bond girls, exactly. You know, exactly. Over the years, right? Exactly. So anyways, when they get to the hotel, so they do the clothing exchange, and what's fun about that is Bond says, "I need you to wear this dress because, you know, I want you to be looking fantastic, and all the players should be distracted, and their eyes should be on you." And of course, as Bond goes down and they get the game started, she comes walking in, and the main person that she ends up distracting is Bond. So that scene is kind of fun.
It is. It really is. And this is like a throwback to actually what happened with Dimitrios and Solange in that first poker game. You know, that's the nice. Exact sort of like impact that he was like looking for, except that, yeah, it's like, oh, you did it all wrong. Like everyone had their backs to you. And like, and he's the one
who's flustered
like,
yourself.
He's like, gulp. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So they start playing poker and they end up, after 4 hours or so, whatever it is, they go on a break. And this is why I have some questions about the security of this particular hotel in Montenegro, because what happens is the terrorists that Lechief had their money, they show up and they want it. By the way, there's a fun moment where one guy has a machete, like he's just bringing a machete to a hotel fight. I do like that. So he threatens to cut off the arm of the woman who's with Lechief.
Oh, you mean and, Kelly Lynch from Cocktail?
Looks a lot like Kelly Lynch, doesn't it? or her eyes actually look a little bit like I don't know. She's an attractive but perhaps a slightly sinister looking woman, that blonde woman.
Somewhere I read they referred to her as Lechief's girlfriend / henchwoman. Oh, I thought henchwoman was a bit much.
not a henchwoman, but you know, she has an evil edge to her. There's something there. Yeah.
She does follow him, like doesn't like she's there when he's like torturing Bond or something, or she was in it later that I was surprised.
Well, she slips him the poison.
Yeah.
Maybe that's what it was.
So, well, actually, then I guess Colin, she does get her henchwoman credits.
Yeah, she tries poisoning to kill Bond.
I guess so.
Yeah. But what happens is that Bond hears this fight going on in the apartment, and so he sends Vesper away, and then he ends up getting into a fight with the guys in the stairwell. And it's a pretty, you know, he ends up strangling one of them right in front of Vesper, and she has a hard time processing that. But there's that fight is actually pretty intense in the stairwell. It's like, you know, guys are, again, kind of messy. People are getting slammed into things.
I like this fight a lot because it's like this real traumatic experience. It's not like a typical Bond movie fight, right?
Right.
Yeah.
There's a lot going on, and it's a huge struggle. And then Vesper has to get involved in it. You know, she's traumatized by this.
Right.
Yeah, for sure.
But I always thought at this moment, this was some strange editing.
Oh my gosh, what I have in my notes here is weird moment of editing, question mark, and Bond changed his shirt. Is that what you're going to talk about? Like why he goes back to the table?
Yeah, he changes his clothes. He like sort of pulls himself together. You know, he takes he drinks a glass of whiskey and he goes down to play. And then immediately they cut to him back in the hotel room to find Vesper. And I'm like,
in the shower,
what?
Yeah, okay. That's exactly why I noted that, because I thought, Am I seeing this wrong? Is there something that's slightly out of sequence here? And then I also had a question, which is exactly how many tuxedos did he bring with him?
I have that. I have that in my note as well.
Yeah. No, the other one, he just takes his jacket off and he has a like shirt and suspenders on underneath.
When
he's wearing just a white, it's not a tuxedo. It's just a shirt underneath.
No. But he, so his first tuxedo was the jacket that she had fitted for him.
Yeah. So then the other one was
his. She sized him up immediately. And then he used that he wrapped it around his arm to try to thwart the machete. So then he goes back to the hotel room and he changes into like a new shirt and jacket.
That's probably his original.
And then he goes, huh?
No, it's probably like what he brought.
Right. Then he goes downstairs and he plays for a while, but they immediately cut back. And then what does he do? He sees her like, you know, trembling in the shower. She's obviously like, she's trying to cope with this thing. She's traumatized. And he immediately walks in fully clothed and gets completely drenched, you know, in the shower. This is a very touching moment, by the way. I really like that scene. It shows like sort of his vulnerability as well.
By the way, two things about that scene. So the first one is that Daniel Craig actually recommended that Ava Green be fully clothed in that because she was supposed to be, the script called for her to be in her underwear. And he pointed out and said she was probably so traumatized that she wouldn't even have thought to take off her dress. So that was the first thing. And the second thing is they actually got that scene on the first take, which I thought was interesting.
Oh, yeah. It's a really good scene. And yeah, I do appreciate that she's like fully clothed in that. And he does the same thing. But then he's going to have to change into yet another tuxedo because that one's all wet.
Right. So that's what I was going to say. He needs at least three tuxedos for this situation to be workable.
But then, you know, we're not a bunch of,
international super spies?
Yeah. or even just like globetrotting rich guys. So, you know, I figure if I was a globetrotting rich guy, I'd probably have like 10 tuxedos that I took around with me.
But was the poker game all in one night? Or was it over?
It was at least two nights.
It was at least over a couple nights. Yeah.
Yeah.
It was.
All right, well, it does get back to the poker game, and this is where Bond ends up losing to Lechief. So they have their first big poker showdown, and it's, of course, four of a kind versus a full house. So Bond has a full house, Lechief has four jacks, four of a kind, ends up wiping out Bond. And initially, Bond wants the $5 million from Vesper to buy back in, but he's not granted that.
Did you even say how Lechief had just totally worked Bond by falsely showing his tell, and he just roped Bond right into that?
Well, the awesome thing about this is a podcast, so you can jump in with whatever thoughts you have.
So this was great. It's like they made a big point of this earlier in that Bond, you know, he discovered Lechief's tell, even though he lost the hand. Because like Lechief was able to like somehow miraculously get the card that he needed on the very last card. But, you know, he told Mathis and Vesper about it. And then this huge hand, right? You clearly see Lechief giving the tell and Bond's going like, yeah, I got him. And lo and behold. And then what does he say? Like,
you thought I was bluffing. You must've thought I was bluffing.
Yeah, right. Exactly. So very, very interesting.
It's a good moment.
Yeah. But I mean, this will come back later in the film. It's also important.
But do you assume that in that case that so Vesper somehow gave that information to Lechief?
No. He thought it was Mathis.
He thought it was
No, I know he thought it was Mathis,
yeah,
but I'm saying
because Vesper wasn't supposedly at this point, Vesper hadn't betrayed him yet.
So we don't know if it was Mathis or Vesper.
Right. I just don't think. I think the hotel business is baloney. Like, I think it's just gimmicky.
The hotel Hollywood business is a multi-billion-dollar industry.
No, the tell.
oh, the tell.
The poker tell, like in Rounders, also, and all that stuff. It's just such like, oh, I'm doing the same Oreo thing.
I don't think it is.
I mean, Rounders is obviously more.
I think it's a thing. But like, I think he's very right. It's like you play the player across from you.
I agree, but I don't think someone's going to be like, I think, what was his tell? Like tapping his forehead or something? I don't know.
It was like
the same
like
exact thing.
His eye.
It was like taking an Oreo and taking it apart slowly and then listening to the Oreo for a minute. Yeah, like that exactly. Kind of thing.
It's just, to me, that's just a little.
Hey, the man, he's money.
I think it's more, Attell is more like, how are they betting and how are they playing the game? Not like a physical character, like something they're actually doing.
Yeah. All right.
It does show better on Hollywood, on screen, right? You have to see something. You have to want to like, oh, it's that. His eye starts weeping blood when he has a good hand.
Well, and the other thing that happens during this sequence is this is where Bond ends up ordering a drink. And of course, you know,
that was fantastic.
The longer term, Bond drink ends up being a vodka martini, shaken, not stirred. But in this case, he actually is ordering the drink that he orders from the book.
I did love that sequence because he like has this whole elaborate order. He's ordering a Vesper, which is a type of drink.
Well, he creates it. Like he like creates this drink right there on the fly. And you're right. Yeah, it's from the book. I've actually made it myself. It is quite good.
Is it good?
Yeah.
What I loved was all the other poker players being, oh, yeah, I'll take one of those.
Exactly. That's great.
The chief's getting all annoyed. He's like, can we just play poker?
I like Felix, though. He's like, I'll have one of those, too. Hold the fruit.
That was great.
Well, and so the drink, I mean, the history of the drink is kind of interesting, right? Because it was in the original Fleming novel. It's, again, the recipe, 3 ounces of gin, 1 ounce of vodka, half an ounce of, so in the book, originally it was Quina Lillet, right? So Quina Lillet is not actually produced anymore.
Nope.
Right, so apparently now it is Lillet Blanc that you use, or I guess the substitute that you can use is dry vermouth. And then, of course, you use a lemon peel for garnish. But I do just the evolution of the drink, because at one point, you know, he ends up asking for a martini and the bartender asks him if you want it shaken or stirred. And he's like, I don't care.
Do I look like I give a damn?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So the interesting thing about this drink is that it has both gin and vodka, which is very, very unusual.
Right.
But apparently the vodka tempers the botanicals in the gin, which makes it very well balanced.
I actually want to try one. After watching this movie, I'm curious. I'm like, I wonder what that tastes like.
Well, you want to come over? I've got some Lillet Blanc and gin and vodka. I can easily make you.
Let's do it. Let's play some poker, Tim.
We should have had some made up before the game, before the podcast.
I don't think we'd be able to make it through the podcast if we're slamming down Vespers. Although I'm sure it would be an interesting podcast.
Podcast would get a lot more interesting towards the end. That'd be fun.
Get quite lively.
Maybe we should try it sometime. Okay, so then Bond ends up, so this is where he has an encounter with Felix out in the hallway. And so, because Vesper is not going to fund Bond with the additional $5 million. By the way, I'm assuming that her choice in not funding him at that point is because she actually doesn't want to give him the opportunity to win it back, right? So she's actually working on behalf of Lechiffre with that decision not to fund him. Do you agree?
I don't think so. No, because the way M explains it at the end, she didn't turn until later, right?
Well, until she ends up cutting a deal for his life, basically, the money for his life. But I was just wondering in terms of why not give him the $5 million, because he just fucked up the hand, or because she thinks it's
all ego at this point. You lost because of your ego. And right. So she doesn't think it. She thinks it's too much risk. We're not going
to
give
another $5 million to terrorists.
Yeah, right. But then Felix ends up agreeing to stake him. The Felix dialogue in the hallway is pretty funny in terms of his poker, because he says, "I'm bleeding chips.
Yeah.
I'm not going to last much longer."
It's almost like he's dying on the battlefield. Yeah, exactly.
It's a very dramatically delivered line from Jeffrey Wright, and he's talking about his poker situation. So his chip stack. Yeah. So that I thought was kind of funny.
I do like that too, because then he's like, but we get him. We get Lechiffre. You know, if you win, then we get Lechiffre. He's like, fine. He's like, well, what about the winnings? And Felix says, does it look like we need the money?
Right. Yeah, I love that. Yeah. And then this is where, so after I think Bond orders maybe his second Vesper martini, he is poisoned by Lechiffre's henchwoman. This is a pretty fun scene, because Bond is, he realizes he's been poisoned. And so the first thing he does is he just grabs some salt, walking across the table, goes to the bathroom, you know, mixes some salt in water, makes himself throw up. And then from there, he rolls out to the parking lot, where luckily his car has a built-in defibrillator, which is of all the spy gadgets to have with you, that was a pretty handy one to have at the time. And this is kind of a fun scene too, because he has the tracker in his arm, and so he's coordinating with the group at home, and there's a whole group of people that's like, all of a sudden it's like NASA, it's Apollo 13 trying to solve the problem for Bond. It's like everybody's crowded around the monitors. It's like, you got to do this, you got to do that, you got to do this. And just push the tension of that button. Scene. Yeah. just the tension of that scene, I think, is great. I think it's great. It's really
well executed. And his acting is, I don't know how he's getting his veins to bulge and just like.
Oh,
his,
I know, right? Oh,
it's amazing.
He's like just sweating up a storm.
He's selling the physical acting there for sure.
He is in rough shape.
Yeah.
Looks like he's about to die and he's been poisoned.
Yeah.
he really, really looks it. It's great. Great job.
This is like one of my favorite scenes as well. It's short, but it's very exciting. It's a good like sort of punch in the middle of like these poker games, and all of a sudden it's like, ooh, high tension all of a sudden. Really, really a lot of fun.
Yeah.
Dave, that was a 2007 pre-production Aston Martin. They took out the defibrillator for the production models.
I don't know why. I mean, you could just use it casually. You could just go down. Hey, who wants one?
I like how, like, you know, he ultimately, like, he passes out before being able to fix the defibrillator. And then, of course, who shows up? Vesper. And she saves him. And when he comes to, he looks at her and he goes, "You okay?" She's like, "Wait, what?"
That's a good moment. And then, of course, what's awesome about that whole scene is he just buttons up his shirt, goes back to the poker table, starts playing poker again.
Yeah, and of course, Lashif is just sort of like, "Wait, what the fuck? Like, how are you still alive?" And he goes, "That last hand nearly killed me."
Yeah. So then this gets to the big poker hand, and again, of course, it's. I do have some questions about the sequence and the style of play that's happening here, because what they say is that so Bond has a suited 5-7,
yep,
and so he decides to stay in the first round to see the flop with a suited 5-7, which I question whether or not you would do that, but okay, let's just say that he stays in.
Let me just tell you, as a poker amateur,
yes,
I would do that. I would.
Absolutely, really?
Yeah, because they're suited. Yeah.
Well, I don't know. I mean, so, but the sum total of what each player had to bet prior to that flop would have been $6 million, because there's $24 million on the table is what Mathis says at one point. So it was $6 million to see the flop. And so at that point,
well, I think he has probably the big blind at that point was like $2 million.
Yeah. That doesn't seem like that much.
Yeah. But of course, you know, what happens is it comes down to, Lashif has a full house. And Bond after the flop has an open-ended straight draw for a straight flush, and Bond of course ends up. So I think Bond has it on the turn. I think, right?
I didn't see the full.
By the way, this is the point in the podcast where my wife, who will be listening to this, hi Emily, where she's going to go. I have no idea what you guys
are
talking
about. Shut
the
fuck up, you poker nuts. All right. Okay. Fair enough.
No, it's fine. Go ahead. Go ahead.
It did end up being, the whole hand is ridiculous. The fact that there's four players still in it, each one's getting a better and better.
Right. I mean, in fact, I looked up the odds of
a four player all
of four players having those hands, and it's just, you know, it's astronomical against it actually occurring. It's possible, but it's.
So you're saying there's a chance. But I like it. I like it. It's exciting. It's exciting.
I played poker with Larry a couple times, and they play pretty high stakes, but still no one's ever been poisoned at any of those games.
Yeah, so Bond, bottom line, ends up winning. So he has the straight flush, best hand you can get, with the possible exception of a higher straight flush, also known as the royal flush. Soon after this,
And by the way, when he does win... He just flips the dealer a $500,000 card, like,
right?
As a tip. That's pretty nice.
By the way, do you think? Actually, I had a question about that, which is, do you think?
I thought the same thing, because it's not, the money's not there. He has to put his money into it. It's just fake chips.
That's awesome.
With this.
Exactly. I thought that same thing, right? So
No, because the casino is going to be like, oh, hey, he tipped him. So
yeah, he tipped him.
He's got to go to Monsieur Mendel and say like, hey, buddy, how about a little something, you know, for the effort.
What do you think about Bond's expense report too? Do you think it's within the G7 policy to be able to tip $500,000?
I think what we didn't see was Vesper swooning at that point. By the way, do you know why he gave him $500,000 as a gratuity?
Because he won
for flipping that straight flush.
No, it was specifically for the way the dealer pronounced showdown.
Soon after the game ends, Bond, so Vesper says something about that, oh, that she receives a, oh no, she's having dinner with Bond. And at that point, you can tell that, you know, she's definitely into Bond at that point, right? She's, you know, he's finally started to wear her down a little bit, and they're having a different conversation. This is where he notices the necklace and says that it's an Algerian love knot or something like that. So, but then, so she mentions that Mathis calls her and she's supposed to connect with Mathis. This is one thing I didn't quite understand, this, because she leaves and then all of a sudden Bond goes, Mathis, like he has this revelation that, that there's a, he thinks that, but I'm exactly why that, I had a question here. Explain it to me.
No, this is my exact question as well. I'm like, well, what is it about, what did he just realize about Mathis?
I don't understand what he realizes. So
he realizes that Mathis is, gave him the tell, and that's why, how he knew he was bluffing.
To me, it wasn't very clear. Like, they didn't even give you any insight into what it was.
No, because remember, like earlier, Mathis is one, he's like, oh, Mathis is the one who must have told him that I knew his tell.
So here's the thing about the tell as well, because when, so he sees the tell and then, he tells, Mathis and Vesper about it, right?
Yeah, the first time.
But he ultimately, he actually lost on that hand.
Yeah, they're like, oh, you lost. He's right. Like, no, it's okay, because I know the tell now.
Then on the next one, he's doing the tell, and Bond's like, oh, I'm going to get him now. And yeah. And he, you know, he was a fake out. So yep. Now what I was thinking was that this was all a setup from the beginning. Like, this is a way for Lechiffre to, like, fake out other players by showing a false tell and then springing the trap on them. But apparently it wasn't, because in the, like, one of the later rounds before the final showdown, Lechiffre does the tell and then he catches himself and then he just folds. So it really was a tell.
Right. Yeah. I don't, so actually maybe this is a, Hey, Real DMC community, someone shoot us a message at feedback@realdmc.com. Explain what it is that, tipped Bond off to, or basically tripped Bond's concern alarm over Mathis, because I still don't get it.
Hey, I mean, he must have just been thinking about, like, in his mind, like, going over, like, how do you know? Yeah, how do you know about the tale? And then he's like, well, who did I tell? Vesper and Mathis. Well, it can't be Vesper, because we're in love, and she's on my side. And so it was like, Mathis.
Yeah.
But why then? Why exactly then? I felt like they didn't sell it enough. Yeah. It was just sort of like, we got to get from point A to point B.
Yeah. And well, and then from here, Bond jumps in his Aston Martin and he is pursuing what he thinks is Mathis potentially. Oh no,
Vesper gets kidnapped.
He sees Vesper get kidnapped. So he sees her get pulled into a car. And so then he goes screaming after her and he comes around a corner and she's laying in the middle of a road. So he swerves to go out of the way. And this is the world record that I referenced at the beginning of the podcast, which was that they were able to get the car to do a full complete 7 rolls, which is apparently a Guinness Book of World Record when it comes to flipping cars using an air cannon as a stunt. So it's a pretty crazy crash. And during the crash, they actually destroyed 3 different cars that were valued at $300,000 each. So it was $1 million stunt to pull off.
Just awful, awful, because that car is just really nice. An amazing looking vehicle. Oh, I have to say, car. It is beautiful. And it is an amazing stunt. I mean, it's pretty breathtaking to see it actually flip around so many times.
It reminded me a little bit of, you guys ever see Talladega Nights? Marcus probably hasn't because it has Will Ferrell in it. But there's a scene where there's a NASCAR crash that's going and you see the car flipping in slow motion and they say, hey, let's cut to a commercial. And they do an Applebee's commercial and they come back and the car's still flipping, still rolling down the track. There's a little bit of that there, right? Because it's a pretty crazy roll, actually.
It really is. And that poor, beautiful, beautiful car.
Yeah. Well, apparently those cars were donated or given to them. So they were not, the production did not need to buy them for whatever reason. So maybe it was part of the,
that was the part of the product placement. Well, I know after I saw this movie, I went right out and I bought myself an Aston Martin.
And then this is a pretty effective scene because, and they actually reference it during the movie itself.
Wait, before you get to the torture?
Yeah. Yeah, the torture.
I just like how Lechiffre says at the end of that scene where when they're taking him, he says, I'm afraid your friend Mathis is really my friend Mathis.
Yeah.
So we do know that Mathis
double crossed.
Because there is a question at the end where, like, I think M questions whether or not Mathis, you know, betrayed him.
But yeah, I believe Mathis, doesn't Mathis show up in Quantum of Solace? I mean, I think he does. And I think he's been exonerated, actually.
Yeah, I don't remember.
I mean, Lashif says that he does have that phrase, so it's not.
Look, man, this is only a movie podcast. What do I know?
Yeah, and I don't think Vesper double-crosses until this point.
No, no, she's been double-crossing him from the get-go.
Yeah, they said their boyfriend was kidnapped.
Right, so she's under duress the entire time she is involved in the mission.
Yeah, but they don't say when she gets that called.
No, no, her boyfriend's already been captured from the get-go, from the start. So she's compromised from the very first moment.
But how would they know, like, whose boyfriend to get? Like, I don't...
So Spectre as an organization, or the bad organization, kidnapped her boyfriend and was holding him hostage.
And yeah, no, I understand that. Yeah. But I don't know when he got kidnapped.
Before the movie started.
But why? Because they knew that she might be the accountant assigned to this case?
Don't know why. I mean, didn't go into the backstory in terms of how they were able to figure it out.
Until she got to Montenegro. Like, okay, here's, like, let's dig up information on her. And then they found the boyfriend. And then later they kidnapped the boyfriend. Because why would they? They wouldn't even need to. Like,
it's not clear when, and I don't think we need to belabor it.
I thought it wasn't until this point that, okay, the boyfriend is kidnapped now. She got kidnapped from them. We have your boyfriend. You're going to have to give us that money. And so that's when she finally got turned.
I think we should move on to discussing James Bond's ball sack.
Go right ahead.
Please.
Because the torture scene that they set up, so the first thing they do is they bring in a chair, and then they cut out the bottom of the chair so that he's just sitting on the frame of the chair.
When they sat down, that chair, that bottomless chair, I was like, what the...
The first time watching this scene is just brutal. And then you see
Lashif brings out I believe it's just a thick swinging rope that has a knot on the end of it.
Yep.
So Lashif begins swinging the rope, and the idea is basically he's going to swing it, it'll catch itself on the bottom of the chair, and then slam directly into James Bond's nutsack, which is a very effective method of torture, at least for me, as a point of comparison to other things I've seen on screen, because every time Lashif swung that rope, it landed with me a little bit.
Yeah, it's definitely effective. I like that.
It doesn't look comfortable, let me say that.
He had a line at the beginning. He's like, oh, all these people go into such elaborate schemes of torture. There's a much easier way.
I know. This is like such a simple torture device.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Simple, but effective. But then what's awesome about this is just because he's trying to get the code out of Bond. Basically, he needs the code so that he can transfer the poker winnings. At one point, you know, he's saying something, and then basically he tells him that his balls are itching and that Lashif should do it again.
I've got a little itch down there. Would you mind? He's just like, he's trolling him.
Yeah,
he's trolling the Lashif while he's being tortured. It's a great scene.
Yeah, it's a great, and just the, by the way, sort of the aesthetics and the lighting in that scene, I think are really effective. Like, just, it looks, Bond's pretty screwed when it comes to, or he's in the environment that you would expect someone to be tortured in.
Was it like a hull of a ship?
A container, or I don't know, something, but it's kind of cool.
Great scene. Very effective.
Yeah. And then, of course, the bad guy. So Mr. White enters and you see him shoot Lashif unexpectedly. And then he ends up leaving. And then that cuts to Bond in the hospital. And one thing I would say about this. So Bond is in the hospital. And at no point does the audience receive any kind of an update on the status of his testicles. Which, yeah. After what he was going through, I just wanted, is James Bond going to be okay?
So I did have that question, because then he hooks up with Vesper not too long after. He's still in the hospital recovering. I don't know how that...
Again, he must have a healing factor, because I think he's going to take a couple days off from
relations. I think it would take a while.
I'm just assuming that he was like out of it for a couple of weeks.
It wouldn't need to be.
I think after what he went through,
swelling to go down. You know?
I think you put him in a medically induced coma for 2 weeks and then wake him up.
Well, so. You noticed that, like, when he was woken up, and then he was like outdoors, but he was like in a sort of like a medical hospital mobile chair.
Yeah.
Probably because he couldn't walk because his balls were still so big.
Yeah.
By the way, really nice place to recuperate. You know, this beautiful Italian villa on the shores of Lake Como. Hello.
I'll take that.
Can I go to the hospital, please?
Yeah, that place is. I mean, that the scenery for that and the end scene at Mr. White's house, like, both those locations are just jaw droppingly gorgeous.
Yeah, both on Lake Como.
Yeah, that's what I love about the Bond films. They do shoot like on location, and it just looks amazing. Like the scene in Venice too, when they like they have that overall shot of the plaza.
Yeah,
just great shots.
So I had a question here too, which is, so Vesper is very affectionate towards him here, and it's because they got through the situation, but she seems really, really, you know, genuinely into him at this point. So do you think is she still trying to manipulate him to make sure that she can get the money, or is that a genuine emotion she's expressing? Because I don't really know.
I think this is where she's turned, right? So now she's definitely been turned. Like, it's when she got kidnapped, she got like, hey, we have your boyfriend. You're going to have to give us the money, put in our bank account. So when he comes to, he needs her to put in the code and transfer the money.
I think she's genuine. And I do agree. I think she is turned at this point, but I think she's being genuine. That she probably knows that like they're going to kill her boyfriend anyway. Right. But I think she's like fallen for Bond, but she probably already knows that like, well, I know what I'm going to have to do. I'm just going to like let it go. Go with the emotion, knowing that, well, maybe I'll change my mind like later, or maybe I'll just do it. And I mean, we all know what happens to her in the end. So maybe she's just being a little like fatalistic but also
trying to live in the moment.
Live in the moment. Yeah.
Yeah. I can see that. Because it does cut to then the two of them are on a beach together. And there is a moment where, you know, James suggests that he would just quit and he would want to be with her and they could go around the world. And you do see her, you know, her face shifts a little bit because she's kind of laying, you know, lower with her head on his chest. And you do, when you watch that scene after he says that, you kind of see her, you know, there's a definitely a visual indication of like, something's not quite right with her at that moment.
Yeah.
And
oh yeah. I mean, I just thought she was just like, she's damaged. Like, she's just a damaged woman.
Right.
But
well, I knew something else was up because there was still like 25 minutes left in the movie.
But I think you're right.
This is a false end.
She's probably also just like really struggling with knowing that she's going to have to betray him.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. So they end up jumping on a boat. They go to Venice. As they're cruising through Venice, there is an evil villain that is tracking them. And you can tell that he's a bad guy because he has one dark glass in his eyeglasses right on one side. So he has the international symbol of Bond villainry, which is you got to have some sort of a physical, some sort of a defect or something to call attention to you. So in this case,
something weird about your appearance.
So by the way, earlier when they were convalescing, we forgot to mention that as Bond is sitting there and he's convalescing on the shoreline, Mathis comes to check in on him. And then seconds later, a guy shows up and just tasers Mathis and then drags him away, which
was pretty funny. It was just like,
this is just a hospital where patients, in fact, they drag Mathis's body in front of at least one other patient in a wheelchair that's just sitting there. So I do like that. But the Swiss banker had showed up and the code that he, or the password that Bond had generated was Vesper, right? So she's obviously, you know, taken with that. But she ends up putting in the account because Bond doesn't know it and she's supposed to be the money person. And of course, she gives an account that it goes to an entirely different location because Bond gets a call saying, hey, when are we going to get that money? And from M.
Yeah. By the way, when are you going to make the deposit?
I was like, I got $150 million on me. And then, of course, that leads to Bond chasing after Vesper. And this is one thing that I also think doesn't quite work. So she goes to the bank. She's in there a relatively short period of time. She emerges with a single suitcase that would contain $115 million. So what's in that suitcase? Is it a cashier's check? I mean, what is it? What's in there?
It's $115 million bills.
Well, you remember we were talking about the weight of the money and the size of the money that when we were doing in $100 increments in Army of the Dead podcast?
What bank has $115 million? Like, I can't go down to the Wells Fargo and be like, hey, I'm going to withdraw
like $115 million in cash, please. $115 million
in cash.
Well, here's the thing. Why does she have to go to the bank at all if they were transferring it to an account?
She's probably setting up an account. Like, my guess is it's like the account info, the paperwork for the account or something stupid like that.
I think it's supposed to be cash.
Yeah, I think it's supposed to be the money, but that makes no sense.
Yeah.
No, because what they would have done is like just like move the money around from bank account to bank account and just, you know, hide it, you know. But then they could reverse engineer it because it's got tracking software in it.
Send in Dwayne The Rock Johnson. Please see our Skyscraper podcast for additional information. Yeah.
But yeah, I think
it just needed something physical to chase.
I think we can leave it that the suitcase becomes a bit of a temporary MacGuffin. We're not quite sure exactly what's in there, but the reality of it being, it's a symbol basically of stuff that bad guys want is really what it comes down to.
Money.
But again, you can't fit $115 million in a single suitcase.
I get it.
So.
They're bearer bonds.
Yeah. They could be bearer bonds.
Maybe they're bearer bonds. Yeah. Bond ends up tailing Vesper to a building that is being held up by some flotation devices because it's sinking. So one of the Venice buildings.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there's like most of those houses in Venice, they're like, they do actually have that because Venice is actually sinking. So you're going to try to, you know, get her or catch them, and you're like, yeah, fuck this. I'm just going to like sink this house.
Yeah.
It's
like, wow.
Yeah, because Bond ends up shooting the flotation device and then briefly gets into a bit of a gun battle with some of the bad guys that are there. One thing about that, by the way, so that was the single largest set in terms of like a set that was rigged to move that they built for any Bond studio was the that sinking house. And it was 90 tons, that set that they built.
Wow.
Nice.
He ends up regretting his decision to sink the building because Vesper is locked in a glass cage of emotion. No, it's actually a metal elevator. And she ends up being drowned. And so there's a scene at the end where, you know, she's down there. By the way, pretty good drowning acting, I think, here, right? Because
the rescue acting, his like underwater work was great.
Yeah, his underwater work was really good here. And, you know, she goes from kind of sort of saying goodbye, knowing that she's going to drown. Apparently, probably somewhat, I guess, accepting of her fate because she's already been blackmailed and, you know,
suicide.
Yeah. She is basically committing suicide.
She locks herself in, right? Yeah, that's what I didn't understand why she locked, like, why, like, Bond's saved you, like, at this point.
She,
like,
I don't understand why she can't live with her betrayal.
Betrayal, yeah.
That's the whole thing. It's like, and it's also interesting because he was trying to get her because he wanted to kill her, and now he's trying to save her.
First you want to kill me, now you want to kiss me. Blow.
But it's all because of this betrayal, and that's why she sacrifices herself. By the way,
it's not a sacrifice. That's what I'm saying. Like, it's not a sacrifice. She's not doing it to...
Well, I say sacrifices as in, like, you know, she kills herself.
Yeah. But not to save Bond. Like, right.
I mean, she still, regardless of what they feel about each other, she did still betray Bond, and the money's gone. So even if she gets out...
Yeah, but she had a reason, too. Like, Bond could, like... Her boyfriend was kidnapped, and
I think she Bond did could live with it. I don't think that the English government or other governments could probably live with her helping finance terrorism to the tune of $115 million.
Hey, you know who couldn't live with it? Vesper.
Right. And so Vesper ends up choosing to kill herself, and you know Bond is slightly bummed by that.
slightly bummed by that.
Do you think that's the direction Martin Campbell gave him? Going to be trying to save her from the underwater drowning elevator. You're a little bit bummed.
So do you think, is this at all to you reminiscent of the end of On Her Majesty's Secret Service? Where Bond...
With his wife getting shot?
Yeah. Where Diana Rigg gets shot. And right after they'd just gotten married and then she dies.
The drive-by?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I guess what's interesting about this is they sort of set up this arc, this longer-term arc, where he's still carrying the weight of her death. I know a couple movies in, because I think what's in Skyfall or whatever, I think he, you know, it's referenced a couple times. So they sort of set her up as being maybe the equivalent of his wife. If you recall, what I think was in the opening of For Your Eyes Only, he's visiting his wife's gravestone.
Right.
Yeah, so he's still like within... kind of the canon of their history, he was married. I think this particular version of Bond was not married, I would assume.
Well, yeah, but it's sort of like, you know, he's found love. He's like, he's ready to like sort of leave the service.
He was going
to
quit.
He's in total love with her. And then it just goes to shit very quickly. And she dies. And then he just turns cold. I mean, he just turns cold.
And this is the final moment of the origin story, because it then cuts to the end and what he, so Vesper gave him some breadcrumbs to lead him to the location for Mr. White. And then at the end, you know, you see Mr. White show up at this, you know, beautiful villa on the, what's the lake again, Colin?
Lake Como.
Lake Como. It's amazing.
It's right next door to George Clooney's villa.
So yeah, so Mr. White is shot in the leg, and this is where you then see, you know, he becomes, and I really love this, right? Because at the end, he's standing there, he's got his gun, he's in the suit, he looks fantastic, and this is where he delivers his, you know.
The name's Bond. James Bond.
That's the last line in the film.
I'm getting chills right now just hearing that.
I just think it closes so fantastically, and the fact that, you know, he was this vulnerable figure, you know, up and down through the course of the movie, was still obviously very strong, but then, you know, he has this emotional relationship with Vesper and having to watch her die, and then he's like, you know what, fuck you, I'm just a hard ass, you know, going forward, right? It's like, and then it ends, and then there's probably, I don't know, there's 7 or 8 minutes worth of credits after the end. So
it's, I did like that his gun wasn't the Walther PPK, which is a pretty lame gun, and he had much better armory in this one.
Yeah, that's pretty fucking impressive, that rifle that he's holding.
It's good looking.
It was like, whoa.
Anything else you want to talk about before we get to closing thoughts?
Let's talk about the ending.
Okay.
30 minutes too long. I think it could have ended in Montenegro. I think they could have, like, maybe they sail to Venice and they have, like, the sort of the standard Bond movie ending where they sort of, like, sail off together and they're, like, sort of in love. And then the next movie, it's like, well, what happened to Vesper? I don't know. But you get the whole double cross.
I pushed her off the boat.
You get the whole double cross and 30 more minutes of movie. And I just feel like it would have been a lot tighter if you just, like, ended it there.
Who are you, Marcus?
Yeah, I mean, look.
You're voting for my no false endings.
Well, the false endings are okay, but this one, I just felt
I agree, though. I think it did drag a little.
Yeah.
Well, it feels a little tacked on, and then the idea that you're supposed to ramp up to, you know, to being really engaged in the action at that point, it seems like you've already kind of gone through that, you know, because you don't know any of these characters, really, because you just see the guy that's, you know, on the shoreline when they're going through on the boat in Venice. And so it's just a bunch of nameless people. And so it's not as if you are having the final conflict with Lachief, because, you know, you've come to the villain versus Bond moment. It is just a group of nobodies, effectively, that Bond is there. And it's all about the mechanics of getting Vesper to die. That's the whole thing.
But I think the Lachief ending too, it's like someone just broke into the room and shot him. Like, you know, nothing like, wait a minute, Bond's being tortured. You have this like huge, how's he going to get out of this? Just have someone go in there and shoot him and be done with this. Like, okay, we're done with this scene. Let's move on. So I thought that was kind of a cheap out.
Well, that was Vesper, though, actually negotiating.
Yeah, but you don't know this until the M
like
kind of ties it up at the end.
They sort of thought we needed to get this, like, go all the way through. And the only way for us to get all the way through is to have him complete that character arc. And he has to be betrayed at the end by his love, and he then has to become cold and
the steely-eyed bastard.
The only way to do that is to do the betrayal. I just feel like, as a, for pacing wise and as a movie, I loved the high of the final showdown in the poker game, and I'm thinking, oh, that's it, that's the climax, but it's not. I mean, like, certainly the building sinking in Venice is a huge stunt and everything, but to me, I never really remember that part of the movie.
Yeah, I'd agree. All right, well, what else you guys got?
Marcus?
I think we're 2.5 hours in, so I think I'm good.
My only other really important comment is that every time I hear Montenegro, I think Mountain Egg Roll.
All right, that's an interesting item to close on. So I guess we can end there with general thoughts, so maybe we can go to our closing thoughts or our wrap. Marcus, what do you got?
Excellent, excellent movie. I enjoyed it tremendously. It was a great, I remember when it came out, it's a great reboot to the Bond series. I was excited for it when it first came out, and it still holds up. Still quite fun. Daniel Craig is probably the best Bond and really enjoyable, and this is a great kickoff to that 5-movie series that he's been in. And I look forward to seeing, what's the new one? No Time to Die? Die Another Day?
No,
the new one's called.
No Way to Die. No Time to, No Time to Die.
No One to Die. No Die Tomorrow. What is the new one called?
No Time to Die.
So definitely a great, great kickoff to the Craig films. I would give it a solid A, wonderful film. I do like Skyfall better, but I think that's just because Sam Mendes is probably the better director. But this one's great.
Colin?
I'm going to echo what Marcus said. I was no way interested in the Bond franchise at that point in my life. And then, you know, I saw this. I wasn't even that curious to see it, but I ultimately did. And I was just blown away. This was a shot in the arm that this franchise needed. Craig was instantly lovable as James Bond. Just took that character, I think, to another level. And
lovable is an interesting descriptor there.
When it came out of my mouth, I was just like, that's not quite right.
Oh, he's lovable as Bond.
All right, he's fucking kick-ass as James Bond. And I love this movie. Like I said, like we watch it all the time. It's just so good. My only beef is that it's 30 minutes too long, and you know it could have been cut that last bit. But man, this is a great, great movie.
And your letter grade? Sounds like an A.
It's definitely an A. The question is it an A plus?
Can you go an A? Yeah, you haven't given an A plus yet, so that'd be your first.
Kind of save the A pluses for like the real classics, but this is one, so I'll give it an A plus.
All right, A plus from Colin. Yeah, so I'll basically say the same thing, you guys. I'll go back to Colin, what you were talking about, which is my own personal journey with Bond, right? Loved Bond when I was growing up, hit the Timothy Dalton era and became a lot less enthusiastic for it. And then the Pierce Brosnan movie started, liked GoldenEye, was kind of thinking that maybe, you know, Brosnan could be a shot in the arm to revitalize things. But then every movie that came after that was, I think it's pretty crappy actually. So I don't even know that I even saw them all because they all felt exactly the same. So my interest in Bond had waned quite significantly, but I really did like Daniel Craig, particularly from the movie Layer Cake, or this is a guy that I'm actually really interested in watching. And so when he was announced as Bond, I was pretty excited about it because just that was my familiarity with him was primarily that film. And then, yeah, went in and saw it and was kind of blown away. I mean, I was like, wow, this is actually how to do Bond right. So just pretty fantastic. So it was an awesome reboot of Bond. And I think it accomplished exactly what they were setting out to do. In terms of the next movie or the next Bond, I'm super curious to see where they're going to take it. Because I actually think that Craig is going to be a hard act to follow. So I think that Craig probably had I don't know. I mean, maybe people love the Pierce Brosnan movies. I don't know. I mean, they were certainly financially successful. But I think that maybe some of the backlash that Craig got was the idea that he was not like Brosnan. And in this case, I think that whoever follows Craig is going to be whoever follows Craig is going to be, you know, up Schitt's Creek for the first couple movies probably, and unless they just crush it and knock it out of the park. So I hope whoever the new Bond is, that they're given this type of material to work with in terms of the Casino Royale type reboot, because otherwise they're going to be in trouble.
You're right. Like, you don't want to be the Bond to follow Daniel Craig, which is why they really do need to probably change up the formula a bit here. And, you know, I'd love to see a black Bond. I'd love to see a female Bond.
Idris Elba. Let's get him in as Bond.
He's too old now.
He's too old now, but he would have been an awesome choice.
He would have been great. But
I think they should go Kevin Hart.
Oh my God.
Can you imagine?
You're a comedian. Can you imagine them trying to play it like put Kevin Hart in that and like play it totally straight? That would be fun, actually.
That would be interesting.
Or yeah. Dwayne Johnson. Maybe Dwayne Johnson can play it straight and just like.
But I
that would make it a satire.
I think a female Bond would be really interesting.
Yeah.
I'm ready to wrap unless you guys have anything else.
We're good.
Well, by the way, my letter grade was an A if I didn't say it. Okay. Very important to get that on the record. All right. Well, I hope everybody enjoyed our long discussion of Casino Royale and all things Bond. Obviously, we're all very enthusiastic. We love Craig in the role. We pretty much love this movie. So it was a straight A's across the board, except for Colin, who gave it an A+. Very strong recommendation. By the way, one topic that I was going to bring up, which is neither of my kids have seen a James Bond movie as of yet.
What?
No. And so I was thinking about the fact that there is a certain responsibility when it comes to Bond introduction. Like, if you're going to show somebody, if you're going to show your kids a Bond movie, which one do you start with? So maybe I'll leave that as a question for the audience.
You should have started with, like, when they're 10 years old and shown them Moonraker.
Yeah. Yeah, I would just start him with Casino, like, forget all the other Bonds, start him with Casino Royale.
Basically show them Craig as Bond and then say, oh yeah, some other guys played Bond in these other movies is what you're saying.
Yeah.
All right. Well, getting back to my rap. Anyways,
I can't, well, so why have you not shown them any Bond movies?
You know what? Actually, what? So
why aren't you popping with the Chicago Police Department?
Well, actually, so truthfully, I brought it up as an option for them a couple times. I'm like, hey, you want to watch this? This is a fun series, fun spy movie. Nah, not really. They just weren't interested.
Oh, wow. Sounds lame, Dad.
Yeah. All right. Well, I hope you enjoyed our long conversation about Casino Royale, poker, Bond. Again, we're huge fans of this movie. We all love it. So, and we're all looking forward to the final Daniel Craig Bond film. All right. And with that, this is the Real DMC Podcast, signing off. Goodbye, everybody.
Bye, buddy. Bye.
All right. Let's stop this thing.
All right.
This is, I think, officially our longest podcast.